Jane. How are you?
Good, thank you. Have you had a good week?
Ooh, absolutely marvellous.
Good.
I don't know, I've forgotten what's happened, but I know what's happening right now. I'm very excited because we've got Robin Maynard here, who is an environmentalist, and he's got loads of things to tell us about sustainability, about how we can make a better world, and I'm really excited.
Very nice to be with you. Thank you for the invitation.
Can you introduce yourself properly?
Oh, gosh, I'll try. So, yes, my name's Robin Maynard, and I've been really fortunate to work in the environment movement for many years. I walked into Friends of the Earth as a volunteer back in, gosh, about 1985. And then, sadly, the next year, Chernobyl blew up, and it sort of gave me a job trying to track the radioactive plume from that terrible disaster across the UK. But it led to me becoming part of Friends of the Earth, and my path was found. So that set me on the right track, I guess, in a dark way. Silver lining to a black cloud.
Robin, I remember meeting you when I first came to London. And when I first came, I made friends with Trilby, and you know, I just absolutely was so happy to arrive at Trilby's house. And I think you were
a lodger with her mum. Yeah.
Rose,
she was a wonderful force. Oh, Rose. Oh, yeah. She's a sort of about this tall, but you wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of Rose. She was the most lovely person. But I think I think I took too many baths or something once, and she gave me a pretty stiff talking to. Yeah. And no, she was fabulous. And she actually had a burglar tried to break in one day and was sort of trying to get through the door, and she just threw pots of jam at him until he disappeared, you know. And she was having none of it. And she's an absolutely wonderful lady.
It really is. I mean, when I arrived at her house, you know, I was quite different to my family. And, you know, I'd been on a CND march. And, you know, I was a vegetarian, and I got to Trilby's and I was like, these are my people. And then Jonathan Burrett lived upstairs. And I was like, how
yes,
can this
there you go.
Be?
Perfect. Perfect.
And so, I remember you meeting, I know that you were very good friends with Trilby, and she used to tell me all about you and stuff. And I remember, because Jane, you know Trilby, don't you? Trilby,
yes,
and Shelley.
Not very well, but yes, I know them as from yes. meeting you.
Yeah, and Trilby's mum, Rosie, had this amazing place in Suffolk. It was like to Artist Shack, and lots of strange things used to happen there. I mean, Trilby took me for the first time, and we lived on raspberries for a week. We went on a strange diet, and then when it was the full moon, she wheeled me round in a wheelbarrow naked down the garden. And then Robin, is this true? She told me that you stripped off, I think, at Suffolk and ran in naked.
Probably, yeah. Yes, it wouldn't surprise me at all. I don't remember being in a wheelbarrow, but when one must be close to nature. When I was lucky enough to work at the Soil Association, was talking to growers, and they say, and there is actually scientific evidence, you've got to get your hands in the earth, because you'll know this because you're both gardeners and allotment, aren't you? And there are little microbes which actually work with our immune system. You know, actually a peck of dirt is really useful for us. You know, we've got to clean and sterilized everything, and, you know, antibiotics in your chopping boards, it's bonkers. You know, we actually need to have that sort of connection with nature and interaction with it, because that makes us healthier, you know, mentally, physically, and I would say spiritually too, you know.
Yes, because there is so much talk, isn't there? I remember my auntie and my mum were great gardeners, but my mum used to always chastise my auntie for not wearing gloves when she was gardening, because she'd probably read something in the Daily Mail that said you shouldn't, and you shouldn't use your bare hands.
I mean, you have to be careful as well, I suppose. But I just really remember that podcast when Mark Rylance took Indra out to the forest ahead of, you know, the cast getting ready for Jerusalem, which I was really privileged to see years ago at the Royal Court, and was just blown away by it. But, you know, his whole thing of being in the forest, I mean, that is, we now call it, I mean, the Japanese have a name for it called Shinrin Yoku, which means forest bathing. And it is just being in all the sort of whatever the trees exude, they make you feel better. And it's like it is natural healing, you know, and it is a natural health service, I guess, isn't it, in a way?
But how, Robin, do we encourage a wider population to go into the forest rather than being on their computers or playing a video game?
Yeah, I mean, brilliant question. I mean, actually, I should never say brilliant question. Have you noticed they always say that on the radio now? It's almost like a way of trying to disarm the interview. So, oh, very good question. Please don't ask me anything difficult. No, but there are some really positive things happening. So, I mean, my little girl at her school, they've been doing forest schools, you know, and it's a state school, you know, and they take the children out into, you know, a patch of woodland or just a bit of green space near to them, and they just do stuff out, you know, in the wood. And it's that isn't something which is too distant or detached from anybody. You know, a park is perfectly good. You know, they're not wild spaces, but they are wilder spaces. I just heard a lovely lady called Mary Colwell. She has been working to get sort of nature studies back onto the curriculum. Schools have to teach it. And I lived in, you know, what was quite a small village way back in North Wales. And I remember my class teacher, Miss Allison. I remember she's such a, you know, lovely, kind lady. And she would take us to the local park for you know, to go and look at the ponds and things. And I thought, wow, I can really remember. I mean, I'm 64 now and I can remember it, you know. And so we're not all privileged enough to have gardens or green spaces, particularly in cities. But anything, you know, you will know this, anything you can grow and anything you can encourage children to grow, you know, whether it's cress or sunflowers or anything, I think just starts sowing those seeds, doesn't it, I guess?
You know what, though, Robin, like, you know, when you sort of say that simple message, I mean, I always think, you know, it's like breaking things down so people can understand stuff. And, you know, I wanted to ask you a lot about the sustainability thing in a minute, but you know, when you say there's microbes in the soil that help you, so and there's also, you get a sense of, if you go into a forest, then it's like a natural health service. I mean, it's simple, isn't it, breaking it down into those sort of terms. And you think, well, why isn't that message going out to people in simple terms?
I mean, you're doing it through, you know, talking about bees and allotment holding and, you know, but I think, you know, the likes of Jamie Oliver with his work on school meals, Hugh Fernley Whittingstall and stuff, you know, there's been some really good TV folk, celebrities, if you like, who've pushed the message out. And, you know, the media is incredibly important and to get messages out on, but the media at times doesn't want to talk about certain things. I can promise you it doesn't want to talk about population, which is my issue, because they're all, oh dear, he probably hates people and wants to kill lots. I don't. I've got two daughters. I love people. I want them to have a better life. And I want them to live on a world which is full of all the things I grew up with and more, you know, butterflies, bees.
How do we stop people from breeding them, Robin?
Well, we don't need you. I mean, we obviously need some of us, don't we?
You know, breeding so much.
Yeah, well, the truth is that there are hundreds of millions of women and girls in the world who don't have the choice over how many children they have when, as most of us in the rich developed world do. You know, we are really fortunate to have the technology of contraception, which allows women to have agency and autonomy and choice over their fertility and bodies, you know, so they're not just, well, you know, breeders. They have life opportunities and all the other things that, you know, people rightly want. But in some parts of the world, that isn't the case. Mm. And it's enabling those women to have that choice, to make that choice. It's not about saying don't have children. Say, you know, if you want to have a smaller family, and most of the women I've met, in, you know, whether it's in the slums of Nairobi or parts of India or Malaysia, you know, they want to have choice over their family size and they want their children to have opportunities. And it's pretty hard when you've got 5, 6, 7, 8 kids and not enough income coming in to enable that. So enabling women to have that choice, so enabling modern, safe contraception universally alongside education, because again, many hundreds of millions of girls are not getting into secondary education. They may have primary education, but secondary education, so then they can become, you know, mistresses of their destiny. They have that choice and autonomy and agency. It also makes them more able to be active in terms of dealing with the challenges of things like climate change, because they're informed, they're active in their community, they're, you know, they're putting pressure on politicians, they're demanding things. So it's just a win-win solution. And on top of that, if we can enable people to have smaller families, both in the rich world and the developing world, that will stabilize our population and it will have a huge impact on climate change. It's actually the number three solution to reducing greenhouse gases. But you won't hear the likes of Friends of the Earth or Greenpeace or most of the NGOs talking about it because they're really nervous, you know, of being accused of telling people not to breed. We don't do that. We try to offer choices. And we also, you know, particularly here I am in, you know, Bristol in England, we have to consume less because it's our responsibility to take the heat off the planet, you know, because one of us is equivalent to 16, 20 people in Nigeria or, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, because our consumption is so great. So it's a real balance, you know.
But how do you get that message across?
We've just launched a campaign this week, actually, just trying to reduce the upgrades of everything. So we've, you know, particularly on phones, you know, mobile phones, you know, we're encouraged, we must have the latest model of this. I mean, my phone is far more sophisticated than anything I know how to do with it. It's got far more stuff on it than I'll ever use. But it's like the phone that we've upgraded from probably had another 10, 20 years of life in it. Mm. But you've got to have a new one. And it's same with, you know, it's marketing and advertising. We're just promoting, you know, trash to people which they don't need, and it's, and the amount of, you know, you think about the amount of money goes into advertising products and the amount of money that goes into advertising Greenpeace's work or Friends of the Earth's work or WW, it's minimal. It's not our fault. We are assaulted with this incredibly sophisticated, relentless promotion to buy stuff and that we'll feel better if we have the latest XYZ or whatever.
It doesn't equal happiness, and it's getting that message across, isn't it? That actually this doesn't resolve problems.
Yeah.
Having the latest phone or the latest car.
Totally.
Actually. And that's the message that, you know, sort of getting back to nature and getting back to the simpler things in life actually might you know, resulting in a happier society. But again, it is getting that message across that we just don't need this. And with social media, it's very difficult to get that message across because the message on social media is very much, you've got to keep up with everything and you've got to be a flash Harry, really, to be anybody.
And that's a really difficult thing, isn't it? To get celebrity influencers who are influencing less is more, you know, that actually you don't need all the bling, you know, you don't need to get into a private jet to fly 10 miles to pick up, you know, all that sort of bonkers stuff we've seen on social media. You don't need the great big car, you know, actually it's much cooler to be, you know, it's settled in yourself and in your community and with your friends, these things which sort of, which are not tangible things, you know, they're more sort of connections. I mean, one of the happiest countries, I think it is the happiest country in the world, is Costa Rica on the happiness index. And and there it's a really, I really want to go to Costa Rica. I know, you know, I obviously have to think about my air miles and all, you know, how to offset that, etc. But they were in a very poor state about 60 years ago. They had massive deforestation. Their income per head was really low. They were the highest fertility rate, so the number of kids were being born per woman was really high. They were in a really bad state. And it was actually a forester who was trying to understand why so much of the native forest was being cut down by the people. And he had the sense, you know, which is, you know, aren't always there, to talk to the community, to talk to the women, say, well, why are you doing all this? And they said, well, because we've got so many kids. We have to clear land to feed them. You know, we don't want to have such big families. And light bulb moment. And he worked with the local community and equally with the Catholic Church on the ground, which was cool, to provide the contraception those women wanted. They did other things as well, but over the past 60 years, they've turned Costa Rica around. So their fertility rate is really low. They're having, you know, just about replacement level. Their income has gone up. It's like 10 times what it was 60 years ago, and they've regenerated 70% of their forest, and they are sort of ecotourism destination of the world, and they're one of the happiest places in the world. So it's like, you can do it. And countries like that really make you think, yes, with the right policies, you know, and the right leadership, rather than some of the interesting folk we have around at the moment who don't seem to have any long-term vision, you know, sort of short-termism. And
I mean, I think Greta Thunberg was such a brilliant influence, and because she was so young.
Exactly.
But, you know, even her frustration was you know, apparent at just not getting anywhere. I mean, you know, young people did get on board, but the politicians didn't particularly get on board.
It's hard to make the change when people are, you know, because politicians have control over the levers of power, and it's how you enable them to change. I mean, politicians are largely behind the public, it seems to me. They follow, you know, particularly at the moment, because they follow what, suddenly we'll get excited, you know, we'll support that. And that sort of, that's tragic, because they claim to be leaders, but they're not, they're followers. So they can be influenced. And I think, you know, if children are very powerful, because although, you know, adults can be, you know, paternalistic and dismiss them, it's also embarrassing for them if they are confronted by a child just telling the truth in a way that, you know, no disrespect to Greta, but she was a child when she started speaking her truth, you know, and that made it very uncomfortable for some of those grown-ups, you know, when she addressed the UN, for example. But it's then translating it into action and making them actually do something about it. And it seems like we absolutely know what to do, but we're not doing it fast enough. You know, and there was a brilliant interview on, it was on the Today programme. I won't say the presenter because it would embarrass him, but it was at the time when, you know, COVID had been going on, etc. And there was a young girl who was, you know, set to be doing her GCSEs. And the presenter said, oh, you must be, you know, it must be really awful being out of school and you worry about your exams. And she said, well, yeah, I'd really like to be. Oh, no, it was, because it wasn't COVID. It was that heat wave, that incredible heat wave when school started. And she said, well, yeah, you know, yeah, it is. You know, it's a real shame with my exams. But actually, what I really worried about is we should be changing our lifestyles to deal with this. And he just laughed at her. And it wasn't a nasty laughter. It was laughter. I don't sort of understand what you're saying. As if it was an absurd thing. So she's absolutely nailed it. We have to change our lifestyles. And no politician dares say that. I mean, what is our dear new government saying? Growth, growth, growth. It's growth which has got us into this jam. This is where we're at. And we'll deal with the environment when the economy is growing. There won't be a flipping economy if you don't have an environment, guys.
You know, I think it takes people like you and people who are, you know, proper leaders who have got, are ahead of the time, who've got new ideas. That's what we're looking for. But everybody's sort of understands what sustainability is, or do they? They know this word sustainability. I mean, you know, hopefully people are understanding it more, you know, but it's not really in the news every day. It needs to be in the news every day, doesn't it? It needs to be the forefront of the news every day.
And what's the sustainability report, shouldn't there? Like, you know, like we're going to do business report. Now we're going to do sports. Yeah. Now we do weather. Well, let's do sustainability. Well, I'm sorry, folks. We're in a bit of a difficult situation. You know, like there's this wonderful organization called the Global Footprint Network, and they each year they have something called Earth Overshoot Day, where they've calculated when all of us collectively, all humanity, has used up everything the Earth can provide for us renewably in a year. And when it first started in like 1970-71, Earth Overshoot Day fell on like the 29th of December, so we were almost, as a species, as a race across the world, in balance with the Earth's resources. I think this year it fell into around August or July. So it's, you know, we are well overshot. So if everybody lived like we do in the UK on average, we'd need about 1.8 Earths. So, you know, that's, we haven't got them, have we? If we all lived like Americans, we'd need 5. And it's like, yeah, and there are some people, you know, who are living below. So, you know, in India, although there's an awful lot of people there, they don't consume a huge amount. So they're within balance. But it's like, overall, we're out of balance, and some of us are taking too much, and we need to, you know, we need to reduce so others can increase, you know, have more. It's fairer shares of what the planet can, you know, as an allotment holder, you can't get more out of the earth than you put in, you know.
Mm. I mean, it's interesting, this the fuel crisis, and so, you know, kind of energy costs going up. It's interesting how that is going to affect people, because everybody's going into panic right now, even though the government are trying to help out. But the idea of putting a jumper on instead of turning the heat up. And we don't need to have such hot houses. So it will be interesting how people do deal with that. Certainly environmentally, it's going to be better, isn't it? Not using as much fuel.
Yeah. And it's, you know, of course, we have to look after people who are fuel poor and are not going to, you know, are going to really suffer from not being able to heat their homes or, you know, and afford the gas, oil, electricity, et cetera, you know, but that's perfectly manageable. But, you know, what we've done, you can hear it in the government's announcements, there's no thought about managing demand. It's all about increasing supply. Okay, so we're gonna get fracking again, you know, which is probably the stupidest suggestion from the new business secretary you could ask for. He doesn't believe in climate change either. So Jacob Rees-Mogg, climate denier, you know, let's get fracking. Oh, great. The environment is completely shoved aside. You know, no long-term vision, no understanding of the real riches of the earth, just business, a really narrow business mind rather than a smart, sustainable business mind, of which there are, thank God, many more. But yes, you know, so it's like, well, okay, let's insulate people's homes better. That's going to create lots more jobs. You know, that's easy to do. And that's really positive. And it's, you know, people will see the benefit. Yeah, put a jumper on. I mean, that's great. It's made out of wool, a natural product, you know, and that'll make a lot of sheep farmers happy as well.
Exactly. So it's trying to make wool popular again. But I mean, it's getting those fashion icons, isn't it, to promote stuff like that. And also, you know, all this throwaway fashion as well, which is so detrimental to the environment, you know, to get kids interested in... you know, sort of, well, shopping at charity shops for a start, and which is great, because you can get one-offs there. I mean, which are far more interesting than things that everybody can get. But the kind of Primarks of this world, where, you know, cheap fashion is just, I mean, that is just such a massive no-no for the environment, isn't it? And it's getting people to, because it's cheap, to think about why it's cheap.
Yeah, and it's also, I think so much of it comes back to how to make us happier and more content. Because, you know, I know from myself, you know, that I'll buy something and it sort of gives me that rush. I feel better for, you know, like half an hour. Oh, yeah, that's great. I've got a new shirt. I feel, oh, it's lovely. You know, I feel cool again, you know, whatever. And then it sort of disappears. Now, so it says that, you know, there's a real difference between quality of life and standard of living. You know, standard of living is about stuff, and quality of life seems to me about how we feel about ourselves and our connections with people. And again, you know, a real example came to me because I was obviously trying to, you know, I wanted to make sure that I might say, have some interesting things to say to you on this podcast, rather than just be a really sort of worthy old environmentalist, you know, wearing his hair shirt and telling people don't buy anything and don't do anything, and, you know, just live in a cave. You know, I promise you, I try not to be like that. But I was really lucky at one point. I was briefly working for the BBC, and I was sent off an assignment to, because I'd done environmental stuff, I was sent up into Malaysia upriver. Firstly, to try and allegedly to look at sustainable logging, which the government was trying to promote. And we pretty quickly found out that it wasn't terribly sustainable. But then I sort of disappeared and went off piste and met up with some activists who took me up to meet some of the tribal peoples up in Sarawak. And I lived in a longhouse with these people for not very long, about a week. But it was amazing because it was like, it's the wooden log house, and it's almost like terraced houses. They're all sort of joined together, and they have their big log, their wooden platform outside. But the roof space is open, so you can hear all the noises from all the different households. And you sort of go to bed, and you hear the whole community going down, you know, going to sleep. And in the morning, you wake up, and you all wake up together. And because I was, you know, this weird Western person had turned up, they all came to meet me, and I had to buy a huge fish from the river, which was rather alarming, which I was happy to buy. And then I was offered the eye to eat, which I didn't feel too keen on, but I felt I'd better eat it, so I did. But then amazingly, their community was so connected, and we were all sleeping in the same room. So the whole family slept in the room upstairs, including the daughter and her boyfriend who appeared, and, you know, they started making love, and it was like, this is just incredible. You know, this is, and nobody was freaked out about it. And it just seemed the most natural thing in the world. Getting on to the, perhaps the real point story, but this community it was the ultimate flat pack. They could take the longhouse down. And when they sort of exhausted the resources immediately in the area where the soil was needed resting, they would take the whole thing down and move to another part of the forest and set it up again. And I thought, that's
amazing.
But they were so happy, and they didn't have a lot of stuff. Yeah. I mean, of course, I had a fairly narrow perspective. You know, I didn't speak the language, so it's what I saw. And I'm sure, like any community, there were things going on which perhaps weren't ideal. But it was such a contrast to the modern Malaysian life. And yet the government was trying to stop it because they were independent and resilient. And they had this thing called Vision 2020, where everybody would live in homes on their own. Then they become good little consumers and good little, you know, citizens, and they would do what mainstream societies do. And then they could clear their land for planting palm oil. It was like fish cakes, you know, see what's happening here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Robin, me and Jane have been, you know, finding out from a lot of different beekeepers as well about sustainable beekeeping, you know, and, you know, is it sustainable to keep bees in London at the rate that, you know, people are doing? And, you know, so there's big sort of movement at the moment about sustainable beekeeping, and, you know, what does it mean for a country like ours to be farming sustainably, and how can people find out about what that means and why it's good?
We're not generally farming sustainably. We used to be, because most of the farms were what they call mixed farms, so you'd have a range of different crops, and you would have livestock as well, and you would rotate them. So you're doing what those forest people do, you're resting parts of the land, letting it fallow, let it regenerate, and, you know, growing crops which would help nutrients come back into the soil, or animals manure, you know, fertilizing the ground and stuff. And you had to have hedgerows for that because you had livestock. So nature came just as sort of as an added benefit. You know, there was stuff, and they weren't using so many pesticides, so nature just came as part of the system. You know, you didn't have to pay farmers money for countryside stewardship or environmental land management. It was just there. And and of course then we shifted from mixed farming to specialized farming. So either you were purely, you know, a beef or sheep farmer, or a dairy farmer, or an arable farmer. Now, of course, some parts of the country have advantages. So the southwest, you know, lots of quite wet, lots of grass, good for cattle and sheep and things. East, more arable, but they were still mixed and they would still have rotations. But we've gone away from that. So it's much more simplified. And what, again, after the Second World War, First World War as well, things which have been used in explosives or poison gases were ironically turned to hand for farming. So pesticides derive from gases that were used in the First World War to kill people, and fertilizers came out of explosives, so nitrogen. And you know, that's a crude thing, but it's sort of, we're now waging war on the land. And equally, what have we done with animals? We pump them full of antibiotics so we can keep millions of them in close confines. Well, strangely, what happens? The bugs that you're trying to kill become resistant to the antibiotics. So then the antibiotics become less effective. And whoa, even more stupid, we were using the same family of antibiotics we were using in human medicine. So we have dangerously narrowed the range of antibiotics, which were crucial things in very severe cases of human medicine. But then we've had outbreaks of diseases which are resistant. So there was a form of MRSA which developed in intensive pig farms in Denmark. Those are the sort of warning signs. We've gone away from this mixed, diverse system with lots of different things happening to simplified systems, and then they cause us problems. We need these sort of cordon sanitaire and this buffer and barrier of nature to protect us from certain things and to stimulate our immune systems in a benign way, rather than if we make the division so strong, it's going to come back and bite us pretty hard in the backside, you know. If I was mayor of London, the first thing I'd do would say every rooftop must be a green roof. We'll have solar panels on some of the office buildings, and we'll have green roofs where nature, where all this land we've taken below will be replicated on the rooftops. And we'll have wonderful green roofs and vertical walls with plants in them. And we will make this the greenest city in the world. And that'll make people happy. It'll bring nature in, and it will reduce the heat of the city in the summer. It'll just make it a much better place. You know,
but that's a wonderful vision, isn't it? And it makes you feel really happy inside. You looked out to your rooftops, your neighbours, and everybody had, you know, house leaks on the roof, and you know, and everybody was growing green roofs everywhere.
Yeah.
If government were saying, well, okay, we're going to give you a grant, you know, for £500 to put a green wall on you on the side of your house, and you've got to look after it, and if you do, then you'll get a half price one the following year.
And they're doing it in Germany. They've got those vertical, I mean, I've seen it where they've, and they're recycling their water. So the dirty, well, not loo water, but, you know, just washing water stuff, goes up to the top of the building. And then they've got these sort of like, they're like sort of fiberglass pods down the, you know, the tower block. And the water comes through a, you know, series of, whether it's sort of reeds and rushes and different sort of plants, which filter the water step by step, step by step. By the time it's hit the bottom, it's clean and can be reused again, you know, for washing hands or flushing the loo. So, and it's like, this is such brilliant bioengineering. This is learning from nature, you know. So this is not about saying, oh, everything natural is perfect and humans are terrible. It's no, humans are incredibly able to adapt to their environment. But we could do it in such a good way. One of the things around, you know, we've just had obviously the Queen's memorial service and all the around that. But I just saw that headline where the Queen's beekeeper had to go and tell her bees that, you know, their monarch had died and that she was ultimately the queen of all the bees at, you know, Buckhouse and Sandringham. I guess you must talk to your bees.
Yeah, I always talk to the bees. In fact, when I lifted the lid off yesterday, because I just had to remove some wax that had formed where I didn't want it to. And I thought, if I take it off now, I can make candles later on. So I took the wild comb off, and there in the lid was the Queen. She was there at the top. And I thought, oh, flipping it, I've never seen the Queen in the lid. You know, she'd obviously come up through the little crown board hole, and there she was. So I thought, God, I better tell you then what's been going on in the world since I saw you last. So I did tell her of all the things that have been happening, and then she went back into the brood box.
Brilliant. It's rather wonderful that. I mean, I often think, you know, there was something in the news again about that scientists are sort of thinking they're deciphering the language of whales and that we might be able to communicate. If we could only... I mean, often I've sort of, if only we could communicate, you know, rather like Dr. Doolittle to the animals, what they might tell us. I mean, I often think we'd be so humbled. You know, I remember going to Bristol Zoo, which it's moved now, but I never felt terribly comfortable. They had big, like gorillas there, and the gorillas would sort of look at you and they just turned their back on you. And I thought, yeah, I completely understand it. You know, I feel ashamed that you should be in this situation. I know they probably were well looked after, it was all for conservation, but it seemed we have so much to be ashamed of, and we could learn. So, I mean, like talking to your bees, you know, good farmers talk to their animals. They treat them, you know, yes, those animals may go to slaughter, but they treat them with great kindness. So there's a lovely farm I used to visit in Worcestershire, and the family who ran it, they're quite pretty well known, but they treated their livestock so kindly. They knew all the animals by name, you know, the animals would come to talk to them. And, you know, I was being shown round the farm by the, it was the matriarch. She was the mother of the family who'd farmed there for years, and her son and daughter now farmed it. And then all the rooks were gathering. It's, oh, yeah, the rooks, and they're having their chat at the end of the day now. And it's the most natural thing. You know, there wasn't any sort of sense of, oh, this is hippy-dippy shit. You know, this is the rhythm of nature. And, yeah, we respect it. We take from it. but we do it respectfully. And when those animals are taken to be killed for meat, it is done with kindness, and they would only and that's again, they would be taken to a small abattoir, which again they've tended to go. So now they're big abattoirs, and I've been to an abattoir which is a good abattoir, but it's still it's a salutary experience to see so many animals being slaughtered. I think if you do eat meat, and I do, you need to see it. You need to take responsibility and be aware of what your decision is, and are you comfortable with it?
Really, do we need to carry on eating meat, killing things? Because ultimately, it is killing. We do treat animals appallingly, and whether you're witnessing killing animals before you eat them or not, it is killing them. And what gives us the right to be doing that?
I completely understand what you're saying, Jane. And my wife is a vegetarian. I work for the Soil Association, which is organic food and farming. I'm not trying to tell you you're wrong or I'm right. It's just how I've sort of accommodated it. But the mixed farming with livestock can be done. To me, it is potentially, there are areas where, you could say we could, surely we should grow crops. So there are areas where, you can't grow food easily for humans, but you can grow grass, or you can grow a rough type of vegetation like they do on some of these new rewilding places like Nepa State and so forth. And so animals can then take advantage of, solar energy and what's grown to produce protein. I personally think that potentially is beneficial. But in terms of wildlife, one of the most wonderful sights I've seen is a traditional herd of Herefords. And they're the old, they're not the sort of upbred ones. They're the old, hefty old Herefords. Mm. And they're staggering through rough old grazing, nice old grazing, herb rich. And as they scuff through the grass, all these insects are coming up, and the swallows are skimming around their heels, getting there. And that there's the sort of balance, when I was young and we went out for a drive from our edge of town or village to the countryside, one of my jobs when I got home was to clean all the insects off the windscreen and off the headlamps, because there were so many. You get absolutely none now. They've gone. And it makes me cry. I mean, I used to collect butterflies and moths for my dad. And he had this weird mixture he made, which would draw moths down in the night. We had a white sheet with a light in it, and we'd have these amazing moths. Yeah, and I'm afraid we killed them and stuck pins with them and put them into a cabinet. Mm-hmm. But in about the mid-1970s, my dad stopped, and it was like unspoken, but it's just there just weren't so many, and it was just like, this isn't right anymore. And it was sort of, it was a really sort of, I'm sort of getting quite emotional because it was a real wake-up call. It's like something which had seemed an innocent pastime and in a way was sustainable because there was such a plenty, just wasn't acceptable anymore. They just weren't there.
We need Robin. We need Robin to be on Channel 4 News with his sustainability. And here, before the weather.
Good luck with that. Thank you.
I just wanted to ask, before we go, because I think it's quite an important question. What do you think about Extinction Rebellion?
I really like Extinction Rebellion because they're a fresh energy, and it was needed. And, I'm an old environmentalist, and I think one of the most delicious ironies was that Extinction Rebellion occupied Greenpeace's offices at one point to sort of say, you're not the radical guys anymore. And I grew up, I was absolutely inspired by Greenpeace. When they went in front of the whalers, they put themselves in harm's way in front of those explosive harpoons. And they were, there were these sort of wild-haired, blokes and girls in wetsuits and, challenging these maniacs firing explosive harpoons at these wonderful animals. But then suddenly, we all have our time and our cycles. It's like, okay, Greenpeace, you've done a great job. Somebody else who stood on your shoulders is taking it to the next level. I think Extinction Rebellion are great. I find some of it a little bit tiring because I think you should take note of who came before you. It wasn't all hopeless. If it hadn't been for all our forebears, we wouldn't be where we are today. And so I think there's a bit more credit to be given to the great work of Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, World Wide Fund for Nature, et cetera, et cetera. who were dealing with much darker forces and being, you know, treated with contempt and dismissed as hopeless hippies. So we have to keep moving forward, but we should learn from others, you know, who have come before us. That's my only slight question.
And do you think the sort of level of disruption that they kind of cause or attempting to cause is actually the way forward to make people, you know, to inconvenience people in their lives so they do actually think about the environment in a serious sort of way?
I wouldn't be gluing myself to the roof of a commuter tube. I think that's not smart. I think, and you just have to be, you know, they need to be really well thought through such that they are proportionate and justified. But you know, one does have to be a spanner in the works. And I've always taken sort of heed from an old lady I saw at the Newbury bypass who just walked up to the police lines, the security lines, and pushed through them, and they did not know what to do with her. You know, the rest of us all being barged out of the way. And I went to talk to her afterwards and said, "Wow, that was so brave." And she said, "Well, I've always chosen to make a positive nuisance of myself. That's been my," and I thought, "Wow, that is the perfect mantra," you know. So I think one, unfortunately, because things are so critical, I completely understand one has to disrupt people's, you know, routines and not to wake us up. But, yeah. But it's a fine balance of pissing them off so that they,
yeah,
you know, don't hear.
I get it. Yes. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Thank you, Robin.
Oh, thank you.
So if you, everybody out there, wants to make a positive nuisance of themselves, you, well, just enjoy it.
Hear, hear.
Well, thanks, Robin. It was just so nice to have you on. And God, I mean, you're just like a mine of information and interesting things and just...
I see you waffling now. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you. It's been a great opportunity and a real pleasure. And yeah, it's just lovely to have a discussion and a dialogue. That's just been really enjoyable. So thank you.
Is written and created by Esther Coles and Jane Horrocks. It is produced by Claire Broughton and Andy Goddard and partly recorded at the Hives on my allotment near Crouch End in London. Our title music is Sweet Nothing by Amy Mae Ellis and Will Cookson. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Queen Bees Pod for pictures and videos from the Hive. Queen Bees is a Hat Trick podcast.